This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This paper is an attempt to think through some questions about the conjoined history of religion and media technologies in the 19th century, a conjunction I want to explore within the crevices of what I'm going to refer to today as the electric imaginary of the North Atlantic or transatlantic modern world. The occasion for this study is the historical coincidence between, on the one hand, the rise of the modern spiritualist movement beginning in the 1840s, and on the other hand, a succession of new technologies of mediatic inscription, reproduction, and transmission, first inaugurated by Samuel Morse's telegraph, and on its heels, a radical reconstruction of the social landscape of Western industrial modernity. As I hope to show in a very brief sketch, the relationship between spiritualism and 19th century media technologies offers a particularly fruitful way of exploring the legacy of concerns with embodiment and disembodiment that we today are tracing back to Mesmer, among others. And it's on these terms that I hope to offer some insights into this broader trajectory of preoccupations about visibility and invisibility, about presence and absence, and also privacy and publicity, and the way these become articulated together in an age of rapid social, economic, and cultural transformation. Electricity, I propose, was the master trope through which all these discourses, performative practices, and institutional conditions of possibility were tied together, subjected to interrogation, and also contested. Like all things that flow, seemingly autonomously and autotelically, money, water, even the stream of poetic thought, electricity offered the conceptual ground for interaction among a range of cultural and scientific orthodoxies, technological instrumentalities, and sites of industrial production, and also at the level of popular culture, including popular religion. Mesmer's grand theory of animal magnetism, his implicit model of communication between interior souls, and the techniques he developed to bring mind and body into harmony with the vital fluids of the universe, both rested upon and allowed for the continued elaboration of this electric imaginary. 19th century spiritualism and the way in which it engaged with the telegraph, among other things, developed these mesmerist ideas and practices in some novel directions. But first, let me say a little bit more about the telegraph itself. The most revolutionary of the new media of the 19th century was undoubtedly the telegraph. This is because, with the advent of telegraphic technologies, for the first time, and in the most radical terms imaginable, communication had been freed from the constraints of geography. A system of circulation that superseded the physical movement of objects and thereby engendered entirely new possibilities for social relations predicated on simultaneity, impersonal contact, and in the increasingly centralized forms of administrative control. The story of the telegraph's rapid spread across the world is well known. In 1848, only 4 years after Morse had successfully introduced the technology, there were roughly 2,000 miles of wire in existence. By the early 1870s, a quarter century later, there were over 650,000 miles of wire, linking together a sprawling network that serviced over 20,000 cities and towns in a vast area of the globe, from Europe to America, India, Japan, Australia, and South America. Here then, long before the age of the internet, we find the world's truly first motor of technological globalization, in the sense of a formation of a superterritorial space existing everywhere and nowhere, impinging upon every conceivable arena of economic, technical, and social life, from the coordination of capital investments, strategic market behaviors, to the exercise of political power in colonial administration, the management of disorderly urban spaces, military adventure, or new possibilities for romance, fantasy, and deception. The new spaces rendered by telegraphy were the products of the grand projects of electrical engineering in the 19th century, and the technological capacities not just for instantaneous, but more specifically for disembodied communication and contact. Indeed, beginning with the telegraph, the media revolutions of the 19th century enabled the sustenance of one's presence in an autonomous, ethereal world of electrical currents and flows, a parallel universe of acoustic, graphic, and visual representations that seemed to be able to circulate indefinitely, or at least as indefinitely as the infrastructure of technology and capital investment would allow. This was a universe in which human bodies, covered in flesh, impaired by weak sensory organs, prone to fatigue, and destined to suffer rapid decay, could never really enter. To the extent that the new media of the 19th century were capable of duplicating and distributing human presences in the ethereal world of information exchange, vaporizing sounds and images and making them reappear instantly elsewhere, the very terms of human communication had been forever changed. To interact with others now meant to read the traces of their virtual presence. This dream of the instant disembodiment of human consciousness and the transmutation of information from its physical repositories of voice and ear, paper and ink, into the nebulous world of electricity was frequently described in the 19th century in terms of miracles and sacramental power, much in keeping with a widespread utopianism of the period, according to which the progressive powers of technology, and in particular electricity, were poised to deliver long-awaited promises of freedom, ecological harmony, and democratic community. At the same time, we find resonating within various levels of popular culture the ways in which media technologies in the 19th century, beginning with the telegraph, were negotiated within a largely animistic understanding of the universe, where the lines dividing science, spectacle, and magic were often exceedingly difficult to draw. Spiritualism was a particularly dramatic example of the cultural formation that moved within and across all of these domains. The creation myth of the modern spiritualist movement was staged in the modest home of the Fox family outside Rochester, New York, where for several nights in March 1848, the family was plagued by mysterious and unrelenting rapping sounds. Over time, Mrs. Fox and her daughters Kate and Margarita began to recognize patterns in the noises and eventually established a means of communication with their preternatural visitor, based on a system of rappings not unlike Samuel Morse's code that he had devised for his own instrument. News of the Fox sisters' discovery quickly spread across the Atlantic world, turning the women into veritable media stars and lending considerable force to a renewed fascination with the possibilities of spiritual or supernatural communication, modeled explicitly on the near simultaneous introduction and spread of the telegraph. Centered around practices of bodily possession, communication with the dead, healing of mind and body, and social critique, the term spiritualism, in fact, encompasses a much broader family of religious and parascientific movements that includes French spiritism, American and British varieties of spiritualism, Brazilian Kardecismo, theosophy, and Christian Science, all of which emerged in the 19th century and which continue to survive in myriad forms in the present. I think of these together under the umbrella, stenographically, I'll just refer to as spiritualism, and the way in which these various groupings constituted one of the great transnational movements of the 19th century, spreading backwards and forwards across the Atlantic world, from France to Brazil, from United States to England, and also penetrating in numerous colonial contexts, such as India or the Philippines. By mid-late 19th century, spiritualism had inducted literally millions of adherents to its cause, and it was the preserve of a wide range of class locations, drawing in both working-class men and women, as well as numerous cultural elites, writers, artists, scientists, politicians, engineers. The movement drew upon a multiplicity of overlapping legacies, including a variety of mystical traditions both within and outside Europe. Emanuel Swedenborg has spoken to me. The movement drew upon a multiplicity of overlapping legacies, including the case of Emanuel Swedenborg, whose speculations on the ministry of angels were revived in the 19th century and creatively integrated into a variety of more syncretic theologies concerning the unity of the divine with all living things, the coexistence of the world of spirit with the natural world as complementary expressions of what Swedenborg calls an infinite intelligence, the survival of one's personal identity after death, and the scientifically credible practices of communion with the world of spirits. In key respects, spiritualism merits inclusion with a wider family of religious practices concerned with possession, spiritual healing, and supernatural communication found in societies around the world. Many so-called possession cults share with spiritualism a concern with trance states, precisely because they evince hidden capacities of the body and mind, which, if properly cultivated, would represent valuable assets in the search for esoteric knowledge, health, and perhaps salvation. Through the dramaturgy of weeping and fainting, convulsions, glossolalia, or speaking in tongues, and other displays of bodily and mental possession, participants in possession rituals routinely claim to bear witness to the presence of the other world, and in the process obtain new methods and techniques aimed at healing the body or otherwise managing misfortune. Also in keeping with many instances of supernatural possession, spiritualism was decisively coded as a feminine domain. In fact, a striking majority of spirit mediums, those indispensable technicians in control of access to the supernatural world, were women. And this is not especially surprising when one considers how mediumship offered women of virtually any social or educational background the opportunity to earn considerable money, enjoy a high-profile career, lay claim to otherworldly insight, and communicate with the dead, all the while conforming to Victorian ideals of feminine passivity. This was a situation in which a variety of historians have described as decisive for the generation of feminist rhetorics over the course of the late 19th century, as well as the provision of a relatively safe haven for a range of playful, gender-bending engagements with the authorial voice of patriarchal Victorian culture. There are many ways to account for the feminine character of spiritualism, not least the fact that in Victorian culture, religious practice was arguably the arena of activity most open to feminine virtuosity. Nor can we ignore here the centrality of the figure of the female body in this period of rapid economic and social modernization. This was a key site where the benefits and also the detriments of modernity were being staged, interrogated, and contested. And it's hardly irrelevant to this story that the invisible spirits called forth during spiritualist seances were closely associated not simply with women, but with the darkened parlor of the bourgeois home, that domestic sphere, a rich, erratic environment that contrasted sharply with the harsh lights and fast movements of the city, the tactile signs of intimacy, of hands linked together, affording a barrier against disenchanting effects of the relatively male-dominated sites of industrial production and the systems of capitalist circulation. However, unlike many other forms of popular feminine religion that proliferated in the 19th century, spiritualism was distinguished by its intense engagement with the powers of mediated communication at its disposal, from telegraphy to photography and print journalism to later on in the century engagements with the phonograph and the radio, all of which were freely appropriated by the spiritualist movement in the search for vehicles that would consolidate the movement itself, would legitimate its doctrines, and at the same time explore the uncharted other world. Now, there's a story to tell about the relationship between spiritualism and each of these technologies, especially in the case of spirit photography, a topic which deserves more attention than I can provide here today. I've been focusing on the telegraph because of the revolutionary principles of disembodied communication and contact it entailed, which I think were crucial for the generation of the imagined social universe that I've been calling the electric imaginary, into which spiritualism quite decisively intervened. In the context of an expanding reading public, conversant in scientific discovery and the marvels of modern engineering, the spiritualist movement was able to seize on the example of the telegraph in order to elaborate a grand theory of supernatural presence grounded in the mystery of electromagnetism. The telegraph's ability to receive remote messages served as an explicit model for the technical achievability of spirit communication and the basis for a range of spiritualist practices to console those suffering recent losses, to entertain friends, to confound skeptics, or to promote new theories of social emancipation, all of which were realizable within this disembodied spaces of the electric imaginary. After all, if in a telegraphically mediated world it had suddenly become possible to convey detailed knowledge with no time delay, to erase the constraints of physical distance between actors, why should it not also be possible to communicate with the dead? With this argument, spiritualists simply extended the range of possible interlocutors within this new disembodied environment created by the telegraph, where, strictly speaking, communication with those who are distant and communication with the phantasmic traces of the dead are indistinguishable. And on these terms, spiritualists presented what could be regarded at the time as a technically plausible explanation for occult knowledge, aligned with the authority of modern engineering and the still relatively unexplored promises of the mingling of spiritual forces and electrical fluids. However, unlike Morse's instrument, the spiritual telegraph passed not through metal wires and cables, but through the enigmatic technology of the body, and specifically the female body, conceived as a complex of nervous pathways particularly well disposed to the reception of messages from the other world. Here, the familiar Victorian tropes of feminine passivity, moral purity, and the sensitive nature of the weaker sex were artfully inverted, allowing women both to speak and at the same time avoid the responsibilities of authorship, as they proclaimed merely to be presenting the judgments of the dead upon the world of the living. This placed the authority of dead voices, sustained in this ethereal world of electric imagination, in alliance with the desires of spiritualists to make themselves heard, and indeed to remake the world. As I suggested at the outset of my talk, the key metaphor that enabled these articulations, I think, was that of electricity, which in the 19th century was widely understood as an enigmatic divine substance, the animating spark of life, and especially of conscious life, a vital force that preceded, permeated, and survived our brief sojourn in the world of physical embodiment. Of course, the belief that some sort of ether, and this is largely the terms in which electricity was understood as an ethereal substance, the idea that that there's an ether pervading the universe had been prevalent at least since the time of Aristotle. Medieval scholastic philosophers grappling with the problem that they was described as actio in distens, the idea of how can one remote body have influence upon another without engaging in touch. These theories long relied on ethereal models of sympathetic vibration to explain the workings of nature. By the 18th century, this model was applied to the study of a wide variety of phenomena, including gravitational attraction, the body's nervous functions, acoustical and optical effects, and most importantly, electricity. 18th century natural philosophers were convinced that electricity, weather, and life were intimately connected, as seemingly confirmed by Benjamin Franklin's experiments with lightning, or later in the work of the Italian anatomist Luigi Galvani, famous for his elaborate theory of animal electricity. Working within the Newtonian model of ethereal vibration, Galvani identified the nervous medium with electricity, claiming that all animals possess a special electric fluid that is generated in the brain and passes through the nerves into muscles, that would function somewhat like organic batteries. Since living bodies responded so well to electricity, it didn't seem unreasonable to Galvani to suggest that they might also be capable of generating it. The idea of animal electricity was quickly popularized in the 19th century, and here's where I've excised from my paper a longer discussion about Mesmer, which I'm happy my companions in this presentation will fill in those gaps, because this is within this milieu that I situate Mesmer. I want to just trace the way in which these ideas about animal electricity and the ethereal conception of nature were quickly popularized in the 19th century. One interesting trajectory of which is in the form of widely reported experiments on dead human bodies. A very famous one was in the case of a public demonstration performed upon George Forster, a convicted murderer who was hanged at Newgate, London in 1803 and then electrified by Giovanni Aldini, Galvani's nephew and one of the most ardent of his propagandists. These scientific demonstrations informed a widespread popular fascination with galvanism and the power of electricity to create life itself, a thesis which also penetrated into Gothic and Romantic literary genres of the 19th century, most famously, of course, in the case of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And also we can note a variety of literature that pervaded the century, and these themes continued to survive well into the 20th century. One thinks, for example, of the way it's picked up in Fritz Lang's film, Metropolis. The electric imaginary of the 19th century constituted a conceptual and cultural terrain that extended from the domains of technical innovation to scientific demonstration to popular religion, linking together the routine practices of hospitals, bourgeois drawing rooms, and spaces of public spectacle. The telegraph, a device which consummated these mysteries and potentialities of electromagnetic communication, offered a vivid language for charting this imagined world of disembodied space, forging new homologies between the human body and the urban spaces of industrial modernity. The electric flow of the telegraph could be likened to the arterial structures of the human nervous system, or the nervous twitches and flows of city traffic. I would also propose that it was on this cultural terrain that ideas about hypnotism and the family of social forces and movements it embraced were articulated with scientific accounts of the dangers of so-called religious enthusiasm, a preeminent example of which was, in fact, the spiritualist movement and its various occult-based knowledges and heteronymous conceptions of the self. Indeed, although popular forms of religious practice have for centuries been objects of religious disdain among ecclesiastical and political and cultural elites, it was in the 19th century that theological discourses concerning error, heresy, folly, or workings of the devil were transformed into social medical discourses that conceived religious nonconformism or heterodoxy in more specifically in terms of nervous dysfunction. Like opium and alcohol, the 19th century's great diseases of the will, there was a fear that hypnotism, somnambulism, clairvoyance, and other practices related to trance states would transport the heart and mind to unseemly and dangerous places. A moral discourse, the medical corollary of which is found in the claim that with the loss of conscious control, individuals were in danger of slipping or regressing into ever lower levels of personality. This was the conceptual and cultural milieu within which the trope of the often specifically orientalized hypnotic figure, epitomized by the figure of Svengali, and his typically feminized hypnotic subject acquired common sense status by the close of the 19th century. There's a great deal more to be said about this complex legacy, and I'm fortunate here to have companions to help knit some of these threads together. Let me conclude this talk with a few words about the spiritualist preoccupation with disembodied communion and the idea of sustaining one's existence in the absence of a physical body, since, as I suggested, these sacramental theories of telegraphic presence touch upon a much larger project of transatlantic modernity to reorganize the terms upon which the human body itself is animated. On the one hand, these forms of modernity promote the encasement of our bodies in a shell of technological prostheses, while on the other hand, placing new premium on the idea of mutual presence in person, in the flesh, as the last refuge of authenticity in a world of doppelgangers, electronic avatars, and other cyborg manifestations. In our day, we're familiar with this as the paradox of so-called virtual reality. The production of digitally mediated visions and teleactions that don't erase our bodies, but rather lock them into a prison house of wires, cameras, microphones, earphones, and screens. Yet this anxious mediation between body and machine was already present in the spiritualist seance chamber, where the promises of revelation were addressed not through abstract theological disquisitions or prayer, but rather through the senses directly. More precisely, spiritualism enacted a complex negotiation between the agency invested in new technologies of inscription and transmission and the agency of human eyes, hands, and ears, dramatizing cultural concerns and practices that resonated far beyond the world of the occult. Consider, for example, the performance of modern bureaucratic office work, which in the 19th century strikingly shared the same anxieties about witnessing and evidence, the same ambiguities about authoritative agency and the autonomy of machinery, the same economy of gender difference. Like a spirit medium and her clients locked in the darkness of the seance chamber, the modern business employee was consumed by the power of invisible technologies of inscription and the presence of mysterious utterances increasingly divorced from the graphical accoutrements of authorship and the textures of handwriting. Here we come full circle and return to the mesmer's themes of hypnosis and embodiment, of virtual circuits of information exchange, and the physical performativity of laboring bodies moving in sequence with invisible magnetic forces. Are we really that far removed from these 19th century preoccupations with the electric imaginary? Thank you.